Hello. Welcome to the Ubuntu Podcast, Season 12, Episode 6. My name's Alan, and I'm joined this week by my good friends, Martin and Mark. Hello, Martin. How are you?
Hello. I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Mark, how are you?
I'm also very well, thank you.
Good to hear.
Maybe even better than Martin.
Oh, blimey. That's a bold claim. We'll find out later, shall we? So this is episode 6, and in this we're going to discuss Librem 1 from Purism. We're going to have some command line love and your feedback. So let's crack on. Mark, what have you been up to?
I have been moving servers.
Ooh, what? Virtually or physically?
Physically.
Why is that?
I have been shifting some servers, well, my server and my RAID array from my what is currently my office down into the garage for two main reasons. One, because the shelf that they currently sit on catches the sun, and in the summer they do not like that at all.
You don't get that in modern data centers, do you?
No. So now they're in a nice cool ventilated cupboard in the garage.
Ventilated cupboard?
Yes, I it wasn't originally ventilated, but I have a hole saw.
So you've cut through to the outside to give some breeze through, is that right?
Yes, so I've cut a hole in the bottom where it's going to draw air in front of the servers, and then I've cut a hole at the top where it's going to push the air out behind the servers, and the hot air will rise up and out of the cupboard.
Wow, that's pro level, that is.
Yeah.
And trust you to introduce some DIY into your techno stuff.
Yes, well, this is after I ran the cabling down there a few months ago, but I never got around to actually moving the servers. But the reason that this is necessary is that the room I'm currently sitting in, which we call the office, is soon to be another bedroom because my partner and I are expecting a baby in November. So,
oh, woo-hoo! Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Well, you knew that already.
Well, yeah, but we've got to do that for the audience. Pretend like we didn't know.
Surprise!
Yeah, this is new information to me.
It's brand new information.
Yes, so yeah, we're going to be removing the shelf where the servers were sitting, and I don't think babies particularly like sitting next to servers with flashing blue lights on them, so you know.
The flashing lights are good for visual stimulation for babies, however.
Yes, but we'd like, especially blue light keeps you awake, doesn't it?
Yep.
There is that. What? So what's going to be your office now that it's a baby room?
As in, where am I going to be working?
Yeah.
Well, I'm moving my desk downstairs. We're rearranging the lounge, and there's like a corner of the lounge which is going to become my desk area.
Ah, I thought you were going to sit in the garage with your servers because they might feel lonely otherwise.
No. My car is in the garage, so I wouldn't fit.
I love the fact that we're painting a whole picture of your life with every episode that goes by. There's the doors people can think yeah. of, the toilet, the servers with the lights.
Maybe our next competition should be we'll get the listeners to draw a picture of my house and see whoever is the most accurate from our snippets on the show gets a prize.
That's just brilliant. I love that idea. Hold that in your head, listeners. We may come back with a competition. And maybe if Barton listened to us last week and sends us a laptop, maybe we can give that away, maybe. Asking a bit much there, but we'll see. Right, let's get on with it. So recently, the people over at Purism have announced Librem 1, and we wanted to have a look at this, break it down and see what it consists of, and what our thoughts are about Librem 1. So first up, the high-level introduction. You may have seen this already. Purism, who are the people behind the Purism laptops, the 13 and 15, and the upcoming Librem 5 phone, have announced a set of paid services comprising microblogging, chat, email, and VPN. And these are all collectively known as Librem 1, with some additional services potentially to come in the future. And these are effectively hosted applications that you can use from your Android or iOS device, and probably from the desktop as well, I imagine. But we'll look into that as well. So, what do we think of this?
Well, the first thing I thought when I saw this was that one of the things that you feel when you're looking at things like Mastodon and the Fediverse is that you've got all of these instances all over the place, and some of them are just people running them in their spare time, and some of them have some crowdfunding around them, but it's not clear what the sustainability of each instance is. So having something like this where you have these things which are federated services, but you have you're explicitly paying for a company to use their instance of it, that feels to me like there's an actual sustainability model there, which from a user's point of view is definitely a good thing.
Okay.
Interesting. Yeah, there are certainly a bunch of those federated services that have disappeared off the planet. I think that only really applies to that Mastodon, really. It doesn't really apply to, I don't know, does it apply to the email, VPN and chat system? I guess people move VPN all the time.
Yeah, less so to the VPN.
Right.
Is the chat system, what's the chat system based on?
Matrix.
Right, so it's Matrix. So again, it's a federated service.
Right.
I'm not as familiar with Matrix as I am with the Fediverse stuff, but with Matrix, it's a similar thing where you'd have a home server and you'd connect to other people on other servers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a way of giving yourself the home server without you having to host it yourself.
Yeah, or sign up to a service that might go away.
Yes.
Right.
And it's worth, you know, we touched on it there, but it's worth pointing out that these aren't things that Purism have developed. These are a bunch of open source things that already existed that they've taken and rebranded and in some cases forked and are then putting up for a paid service.
Right. And there seemed to be some backlash about that. I saw some arguments that it was a bad thing that they were forking existing projects. What do you think, Martin?
Well, they're perfectly entitled to fork, you know, GPL and open source license software. There's no issue with that. I think maybe what put people's noses out of joint that it wasn't plainly disclosed that they'd forked specific applications in order to create their, you know, their own branded versions. And again, they don't technically have to do that, but it's a nice courtesy.
Right. So they were all listed on the website as Librem Mail, Librem Chat.
Yeah.
And not, you know, Librem Mail, which is actually Kmail client or K9 or whatever it's called.
Yeah, and some of the icons, you know, some of the icon assets are taken from other projects again. So, you know, that was also not taken well by members of the community. They felt that it was a little bit disingenuous.
So how does this fit with the Purism marketing for their products? Like, it's a privacy focused angle, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Their whole shtick is security and privacy.
Yeah, so they in bold on each of the applications, it has things like end-to-end encryption. Obviously the VPN is it's not end-to-end encryption, but it's about having an encrypted connection, and the chat client and my email client have that touted as a major feature.
Is that something people, I guess there's a certain set of people who are interested in that.
Mm.
Is that enough to sustain these services, do you think? Like they're doing this as a kind of crowdfunder, and they've set themselves some arbitrary number of 5,000 to keep this sustaining. I mean, I don't know what happens if they don't hit 5,000. Do they carry on making the applications? Do they just shut them down, or,
yeah,
you know, do they keep them running, but like put the price up for those people who have backed it? I don't know. It's a bit strange. Are there enough people out there who would sign up for this?
So on the point of it being a crowdfunder, that was something that surprised me. In the past, I've been critical of Purism's business model in that they keep returning to crowdfunders as a means to sort of get cash injection for the next product that they want to develop and launch. And when they announced the Librem 5 phone and that crowdfunder that ran a couple of years ago, I felt like, you know, third time round doing a crowdfunder, they don't have a solid business model in place. And then when they announced these services, I thought to myself, that's great. This is, you know, a monthly subscription service that will mean that there's a regular amount of money coming in through their company. But then my sort of dreams were squashed when I then saw, but it's a crowdfunding campaign. And that doesn't sit well with me. That really feels these services are something that they could be selling and enabling for people today. The fact that it's a 2-month crowdfunder had me looking at this with my skeptical glasses on.
Yes. And it did the same thing for me as well. And one of the reasons for that is it feels like we've seen exactly this thing before with indie. Yeah, there was a crowdfunding campaign. It was advertisers. It's going to do all of these things. Give us your money now. And then it got to the end and they said, oh, actually, no, it's going to do this one thing.
What was indie? I don't remember this.
This was Aral Balkan. It looks very similar to this, but it turned out they were only making it for the Mac, which turned off a bunch of privacy lovers who use Linux. And
right.
And I think they just didn't get the backing that they needed and gave up. So there's been some controversy within the first week. Now, obviously, you're hearing this a week after we record it. So, you know, things may change over the coming week. But there's been a couple of controversies already relating to this. There was a problem with tracking things inside one of the applications, and also a vulnerability early on, which doesn't actually bode well for a company that's trying to sell themselves as providing a good service. You know, if you look at some of the privacy services that there have been in the past, you wouldn't expect them to get so much wrong on day one as Purism seem to have. Am I wrong in thinking that?
No, I don't think you are. I mean, it does feel like this was very much rushed to market. You know, I don't know, maybe they're in need of a cash injection, and that's why this needed to be brought to market quickly. I mean, as we record this, it's been quite a successful crowdfunder. Again, I think they've hit 50% of their intended target now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to bring in tens of thousands, in fact, of dollars a month to their organization. What the percentage of that revenue is actual profit that they can use to, you know, fund development of the phone and other products, I don't know.
Well, this is the weird thing. That drop-down list where you can choose what you give, like, if I just throw them $5, does that count as one towards the 5,000 target? So do I count in that 50% of getting them towards their target?
And this is such a good question.
Because it's not clear.
Yeah.
Because they're not transparent about which of the various tiers. And it's not like a normal crowdfunder where there's like a dozen tiers from $1 up to, you know, $1,000, where you get something at each of those tiers. It's all mixed. It's a mixed jumble of paying for monthly services like the various Librem One services mixed in with throw us $5, you know, to fund the thing. You don't need the services, but you're willing to give us some money, thrown in with buy a Librem 5 phone with the Librem One services. And it's just such a mishmash of stuff and not transparent at all.
Wow. One of the options is buy a t-shirt for $60.
Right. Yeah, it does smack of having the begging bowl out. It does feel a bit desperate. It makes me wonder what the financial situation Purism is like right now. But also, I can understand why they're not using a well-established crowdfunding platform. And that's probably because they would have to give up a percentage of their, you know, earnings, and they don't want to do that.
Well, I think, actually, to be clear, I think the reason they said they didn't use another one last time was because the platform itself wasn't open source.
Where's the source code for this one, then?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But the FSF wouldn't endorse, as I understand it, the FSF wouldn't endorse the crowdfunder for the Purism laptops. I may be wrong about this, but this is how my memory went. Because they were planning on using something like Indiegogo or Kickstarter, and that was a no-go.
Right. Okay. Well, that's fair enough if that's the case, although maybe not. But my problem is there is zero transparency for backers as to what these campaigns are. Is this flexible funding? Is this fixed? You know, at what point do you start getting charged? The day you back or in 60 days time? You know, none of this is spelled out. And on all of the other platforms, you know, as a backer, what your expectations are going to be in terms of when and how you're going to be billed and what kind of risk you're entering into. Because at the end of the day, you're not ordering a product or buying a product when you back something on a crowdfunder. You're expressing your interest in it and contributing towards it in the hope that it will be successful. And I don't see any of that on their platform to be able to accurately tell what it is I'm putting my money towards or when or how I'm going to be charged.
So one thing they did do arguably well is the website itself looks quite slick. It doesn't look like your average free software project asking for money. You know, it looks like a crowdfunder. You know, there's lots of diagrams, charts, you know, plans, FAQ down the bottom. So it has the look and feel of a crowdfunder, even if it's not on a crowdfunder website. And one thing they did do, which seems to have split people 50-50, is the marketing video, which is embedded in the page. And if you click play, you'll see it. What do you think about that, Mark? Have you watched it?
I don't think I have watched it, no. I tend to shy away from watching crowdfunder marketing videos.
You might want to watch this one.
I have watched this one. I was surprised that the whole messaging for this crowdfunder was basically a dick joke.
Yes.
Over and over and over again.
Oh.
It's really juvenile, and I can see how it splits people 50-50, because you've got those people who think, yeah, that's funny, you know, I'm using the word junk to mean, you know, looking at my stuff, but equally it can mean something else. What a hilarious euphemism. But the flip side is, what an absolutely juvenile video to make, to promote something as arguably important as this.
Yeah. Now, that video is voiced over by Brian Lunduke, who, as we record this, has just announced that he's now the marketing director at Purism. So I'm going to take two and two and probably make five, but I'm going to guess that Brian had something to do with the creation of that video. And I feel it's way off point.
Right. I agree. He's been involved in videos for Sousa in the past. I know he was involved in some of the amusing but ludicrous music videos, parody music videos that Sousa did. And I still don't understand why the hell they do that. But, you know, more power to them. People watch them and then go, oh, yeah, that's Sousa, that Linux distribution. Yeah. I don't understand. So he's clearly got, you know, past history of being able to create successful video-based marketing campaigns. I just think this one missed the point.
And he's had success in raising money from crowdfunding before as well.
That is true. That is true. Yes. So are there any other things that we can take from this? Any other things that give us an indication of, you know, whether this will be successful, whether they're going to deliver this, and whether they're going to deliver the what we might call stretch goals that are listed on the page?
Well, you know what? I really hope it does. Like, just like when Indie was announced, I saw that and I thought, I really want something like this to exist. So I don't know. I don't really have a feel right now for how successful it's going to be. They have been responding to the feedback and the criticism they've been getting in a fairly sort of mature way. But yeah, I don't know what that actually means, because until this initial period is over and there's actually a service where you can just go and give them your money and sign up. Yeah, it's hard to tell, but I really hope it works.
I think that I want this Librem 1 endeavor and crowdfunder to be successful, because I fear if it's not, what the outcome for all of those people that backed the phone might be. My gut feeling is this is a save the Librem phone for, you know, make sure that that becomes a thing. So I hope it's successful so that those people that put their faith in Purism to get the phone do actually get a phone at some point.
That's an interesting point. You feel like they don't, the phone isn't in a state where it could be released and it's not ready yet and they need more funding to keep the company going.
Yeah.
This sort of angle of the conversation kind of makes me feel, have you seen the documentary on Netflix about the Fire Festival?
Yes.
It kind of makes me think of that a bit, and I really hope it's not that.
Wow.
To put Purism in the same box as Fire Festival.
Well, no, that's...
I agree with you. Now that you've said it, drawing a line between those two things, like people who are good at marketing something and there is a loyal following of people who will believe what those people say and will throw money at the screen in order to make a thing happen because they really want that thing to happen, despite the logistics saying it probably won't happen, is, yeah, that's a fair line to draw between those two projects, I think.
Hmm.
Well, I'll be interested to hear what our listeners think. Did you back Librem 1? Did you back any of the other crowdfunders that Purism have done? Do you feel like it's money well spent? Do you feel like, do you feel safer that they have your privacy in mind? Do you feel like they have the right people on board to do the necessary to make this project a success? We would love to hear from you. And while we may not read out all your feedback on air, we will read some of it. And we do read all of it, ourselves. So, we'll read some of that feedback a bit later.
If you love the command line as much as we do, send us a command that will blow our minds, and we might even mention it on the show. Send your command line love to show@ubuntupodcast.org.
See, Laura agrees with me. right, now it's time for a command line love. And this week, who's gonna do the command line love this week? It's me, isn't it? Okay. Nobody else spoke up. It's me. So this was one that came up at a Canonical sprint where I was in a room with a bunch of the SnapD developers, and I was forwarding some feedback from users in the field. And the feedback was, why is it that when I have lots of snaps installed, it clutters up the output of the df command? If I run df, I just want to see how much space I have free on the root file system. Yet all these mounted SquashFS file systems are cluttering up the output, and it's making it hard to read. And I put this feedback to the developers, and one of them, the lovely John Lenton, said, well, you know what you could do? You could just exclude SquashFS mounts from your DF output. And I didn't know you could do that. I hadn't looked into that, but it turns out you can. And so now on all my systems, I have an alias. So in my bash RC file in my home directory, I have a line that says alias the DF command to DF minus X, which means exclude SquashFS. And as soon as you do that, when you log in from that point onwards, anytime you run df, it does not show any of the file systems that are mounted as SquashFS, which is what all the snap applications are, and it makes your df output readable again. It's fantastic.
It's a nice little life hack that I like it.
Life hack. Pretty cool, huh?
Maybe this should be the default.
Yes, I think we should have this the default. I think we will have to lobby the Foundations team to make this a default in future versions of Ubuntu.
Because GNOME Disks already does this as well, doesn't it, in Ubuntu? It doesn't show all of the mounted SquashFS file systems.
And there are various other fixes that were put in place for file managers, and so Nautilus doesn't show them either. And I think Dolphin, the KDE file manager, used to show them and doesn't now. So there's a little extra flag that's been added to suppress showing like a bazillion file systems. So, you know, we do listen to users and we do pass this feedback on to the SnapD team, and they do what they can to get this stuff fixed. And this is one little workaround you can have to hopefully make your DF output nicer.
Did you know you can come and chat with us and other listeners in between shows? Come and join us in our Telegram group at ubuntupodcast.org/telegram.
And now it's time for some of that lovely, lovely feedback. Paul Waring angrily emailed us, show@ubuntupodcast.org.
That's mean. I started using Ubuntu with 6.04 and settled on it as a main desktop in 8.04. I gave Lubuntu a go after Unity was a bit too resource intensive for my netbook, but eventually settled on Zubuntu and I've been using it ever since. It reminds me of Windows 2000, the best Windows release. Simple, efficient, and has the equivalent of a start menu. I run the latest release on my laptops and desktops, and I tend to roll out to new releases gradually, starting with the least important machine. The last few upgrades have been trouble-free though, so the QA team are doing a good job. I also run Ubuntu LTS on most of my servers due to its predictable release cycle, a version of PHP supported by Upstream, and in terms of getting freelance sysadmin work, most things seem to run something based on Red Hat or Debian.
It's good feedback to hear. Yes. It's always nice to hear that people are getting upgrades done. I remember in the bad old days, people would complain about upgrades never working. It's good to hear that they're more reliable now.
Yes, and I also agree that Windows 2000 was the best release of Windows.
You're wrong. Windows Millennium was the best one.
It was Windows XP, by the way.
Bev Lex contacted us to say,
I was thinking about your segment on advocating for the Linux desktop. In my humble opinion, I don't think it's a good idea to push people to Linux. New users, especially those who are not comfortable with computers, will find a steep learning curve. Using Linux today can be a difficult challenge. Supporting Linux takes time and knowledge, more time and knowledge than supporting Mac or Windows. It's unfortunate, but it's a fact. Ubuntu has made huge advances in the usability of Linux, but until hardware and software manufacturers support Linux to the same degree as Windows or Mac, Linux will always have issues.
I find it difficult to agree with that assertion that supporting Linux takes more time and knowledge than Mac or Windows. That's a hard, it's really based on personal experience, that one, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, what if someone needs support with Windows, I basically just click around where I think something might be until I find something. And, you know, it's basically, I mean, I might, if I happen to know the command on Linux, I would type it in. But otherwise, I would do the same thing. It's just having the confidence to do it. I don't think it's harder or easier.
I look like a complete beginner when I sit in front of a Windows computer these days. I actually have no idea where to go hunting to find things that I need to do when people ask me questions about their Windows computers. Don't know.
Well, amazingly, on modern versions of Windows, you press the super key and then you type what you want to run and you press enter and it runs. I wonder where they got that idea from.
No way. Wow. And on that bombshell, Roger emailed us.
Should we advocate the Linux desktop? The short answer? No. The longer answer, Linux is great. For me, I have an IT background and figuring stuff out is fun for me, but normal users are done if it takes more than 3 minutes to figure out how to do something, and that's probably being generous. They expect things to just work, and they're not going to read manuals, do extensive research, or show even a modicum of patience. As a result, the advocate becomes support. While it would be nice for the masses to use the Linux desktop, I think it's better we spend our time and resources making the desktop as stable and functional as possible for the members of the current niche user base. For there will always be geeks, developers, and free thinkers in our ranks working together to improve upon what came before, and maybe with a little luck, we can turn a few average heads along the way.
It's a good perspective. I like that, Roger.
And it's quite similar to what Mark Shuttleworth was saying in the interview we were talking about last week.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, Ian Forbes emailed us.
Two episodes ago, you asked people if they've installed 1904 and what they thought about it. I normally stick with the LTS versions, but after Alan mentioned some of the improvements, I thought, what the hell? Even though I run Zubuntu now on a 10-year-old Sony VAIO netbook with 2 gigs of RAM and an Atom processor, etc., I would therefore not see the extra performance improvements from GNOME. The new Zubuntu features looked great, however. Zubuntu 1904 is a really good release. Overall, super awesome, so hats off to Canonical, Zubuntu, and XFCE. So, couple of things. First of all, Zubuntu's getting a lot of love in the feedback this week. And my feeling is the 1904 release, generally, not just Ubuntu, but for the flavors as well, was a really well-received release, and a lot of people picked it up and have been using it. I've seen loads more chatter and noise and adoption of this release than I have done for sort of interims in the past.
Mm. This is the first time in about 6 to 8 years that I've run an interim release, and I think it's really good.
Oh, wow.
So why have you run an interim release this time?
I think it's because I had a laptop which I wasn't using, so I thought, well, I'll chuck it on there and see what it's like. And I ran it, and it felt really good, even though I'm using GNOME Shell, which I would never have touched with a Barge Pole before. Actually, it's pretty good, and it looks really good, and it seems quite nice and snappy.
Excellent. If you're interested in learning more about Zubuntu and other people's opinions of Zubuntu, I can recommend last week's episode of Big Daddy Linux Live. If you go on YouTube and search for BDLL, Big Daddy Linux Live, they had a distro challenge, which they do on a regular basis, where they suggest all the participants run a particular distro for a week and try it out. And Zubuntu 19.04 was the one they chose last week, or probably 2 weeks ago now you're listening to this. And they had Sean from the Zubuntu team on the hangout, so he was being confronted with the direct feedback from enthusiasts who were using it, and I'll a brief spoiler, they loved it. It seems like everyone had good things to say about it, so I echo what you said.
I'm going to be put in front of the fire hose of feedback for that, because Ubuntu Mate is next on the chopping block.
So tune into that one as well. That'll be on the weekend of whatever this weekend coming is, the weekend of the 11th. So look for Big Daddy Linux Live for the Ubuntu Mate one as well. Torin Doyle left a comment on our website.
Getting family and friends to switch from MS Windows to GNU Linux could actually cause less hassles for us in the long run. People have plenty of issues on Windows. A non-rolling Linux distro can run along for years without issue or very minor issues. Of course, it also depends on the user's needs. I favour advocating for the uptake of Linux, best done in a tactful way, and never preach you're overbearing or too frequent. Drop some seeds of thought now and then.
Wise words.
Yeah, that does work.
Yeah, and I think it is a really good point to make that, you know, people say, you know, Linux is hard to use, there's issues of on Linux that you've got to sort out. Windows has loads of issues. It goes wrong all the time. Try and print something, you know, things, you get errors popping up for no apparent reason when you don't think anything's changed. The update system is dreadful. You know, Windows isn't that easy for people who don't know about computers either.
Yeah, completely agree. Pablo Massa emailed us.
Please consider adding timestamps to the show descriptions for a better user experience. Now, we think Pablo means chapter markers or something similar.
So, yeah, where we have in our titles in our of the segments in our show notes, adding where they occur in the show to there. I think some podcast clients will auto-link that so you can click it and it'll start playing from that point. But then you wouldn't get to hear the rest of the show. So why would we want to do that?
Yeah.
Well, some people want to be able to link their friends to a particular part, but also we also put our podcast on YouTube, and YouTube, if you put in the description the timestamps, it automatically does it. You just put the time in and it will automatically. So if someone only wants to skip to an interview or the feedback and hear their own email read out and us ridicule how angry they sound, then they can skip straight to that bit. Hey, Paul. So I think the only reason we don't do, well, there's two reasons we don't do this. It's not supported in every audio format, and we're lazy, and it's more work for us to do, and it's manual work.
Yeah. It's mostly the second thing.
Yes.
Because we don't edit the show, we don't actually know what time each segment is going to be exactly.
Right.
So we would then have to go through and pick all those times out and put them in the show notes. So it is laziness on our part, but we do this for free.
Mm. And finally, thank you to John from Winnipeg for your email that was just for us. Thank you, John.
We love getting your feedback. If you've got a comment about something you hear on the show, why don't you drop us an email on show@ubuntupodcast.org?
And that's all for episode 6 of season 12 of the Ubuntu podcast. Thank you for listening all the way to the end. Or maybe you skipped to the chapter marker where I say goodbye. if we put that in, we probably won't.
We're not.
You can get in touch with us in a number of ways. If you want to send us email, send it to show@ubuntupodcast.org, or you can follow us on Twitter, Ubuntu Podcast. And we'll see you next time with more news, community news and stuff.